Yo, what is a cypher?
Too Short selling his record from 75 Girls Records on a cassette tape.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sataro. This week, we talk to Timbisa Mshaka. Timbisa is an author, journalist, copywriter, filmmaker, and pretty much anything else you can imagine. In her career, she's given the likes of Common and D'Angelo their first magazine covers, helped people like Nas, Lauryn Hill, and Beyoncé sell over 150 million records, and wrote and directed multiple film projects from shorts to documentaries to features. As if that wasn't enough, she also found time to write the definitive book for people looking to get their start in the entertainment biz, Put Your Dreams First, Handle Your Entertainment Business. Her latest film, Biscuit, has its New York City premiere this Saturday, October 3rd, at the Oktoberfest Film Festival. We met up with Timbisa at Crosstown Studios in Harlem to talk about all that, as well as the Grapegate controversy. If you enjoyed The Cypher, make sure you subscribe to it on your podcast app of choice. That way, you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. You'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you'll want to check out episode 92, where we talk to Timbisa's model for her music-to-film biz transition, Lisa Cortez. In fact, we begin our conversation by talking about Lisa, the former Def Jam exec who went on to produce Precious. You can find more information about this episode, including a list of the songs we play, at thecyphershow.com. And now, here's the captain of Team Juicy, Timbisa Mshaka.
I didn't get a chance to listen to Lisa's. That is like, she's one of my mentors. Like, I mean, I adore Lisa. I didn't get a chance to listen to it. I'm probably going to listen to it when I get back to the office.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we can get started. You know, we had Lisa as a guest, and you have a kind of similar music business to film trajectory.
Yeah.
Was that inspired by her at all?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, I'm really chasing Lisa Cortez. Like, so, I mean, what she was able to do was just amazing. And coming from, you know, that whole situation with PolyGram, and she actually detailed that, you know, in my book. And I was so grateful that she felt comfortable enough to share that, because a lot of people just need to hear, like, what is it like when, you know, you have a whole corporation gunning for you, and how do you, you're the little guy in like the little guy sense of the word. Like, how do you deal with that David and Goliath dynamic, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, taking it sort of all the way back with you, you know, right before we started, you mentioned that you went to college pretty early, and you did. You went to school at 16.
Yes. So I'm a proud alumna of Mills College in Oakland, California. Yee! And I did start at 16. And my late mother, God rest her soul, was like, check this out. We have a no boomerang policy in this house. So once you go to college, if you come back, you're visiting, and that's it. So really kind of set the tone for what I needed to do once I got there. So even though I was really, really young, I had to find work like immediately. So, I mean, I had scholarships and stuff, but I also had loans and I needed to work so that I could not boomerang back. So one of the first things I did was go to the Career Center and look for a job. Like, what could I do? And I was an international relations major with an ethnic studies minor, but I ended up finding this listing for a booking agency that just needed like a contracts manager, intern, sort of office manager person. So that's how I got bit by the entertainment industry bug.
And during that whole period, it seems like, you know, you were pretty deep in the Bay Area hip hop scene, right? What was going on with that?
Yeah. So I got to Mills in 1988. I mean, the golden era.
Yeah.
You know, is
a couple good records released that
year. Yeah, just a couple. So I was immersed in the scene, obviously. And I started out writing for Bay Area street and club magazines, because the print world in a mainstream sense wasn't really covering West Coast hip hop in the Bay Area until, you know, magazines like Murder Dog and 4080 came along. So before that, you had Klub Magazine, you had Grits and Gravy, and I wrote for both of those, just covering events. And that's kind of how it started.
Right. It sounds very familiar. In college, you get a way to get in free places you would be going to anyway.
Right. And I was underage, so I was trying to find ways to get into clubs, you know, and being press was a perfect in. They weren't going to turn me away. So
yeah,
that all worked out.
Who were some of the people you were interacting with at that point in the scene? Who, you know, any names we might recognize?
Oh, my goodness. E-40 in the Click.
Zeers about my motherfucking capital. Uzi whooping those who take me practical. You know, CLIC can is
motherfucker.
E40, alias Mr. Flamboyant.
That whole family, shout out to the Stevens family.
Yeah, Sugar T is, you know, we'd love to have her on at some point if she's listening.
Oh my goodness, she's incredible.
I knew a boy named Billy, daddy thought he was cool, thought he was too damn cool to take his ass to school, but little did he know, it would have paid in the end, he had to be the class clown to keep up with his friends, at least he thought they was.
Sebo from Sacramento. Oakland. So at that time, MC Hammer was independent. Too Short was independent. They eventually both attended one of the events that I put on at Mills College. I used to do these hip hop panels at Mills to sort of bring the Oakland community into the campus community and to educate our students, frankly, about hip hop and by extension about Black culture. Because a lot of the women that came to school there, they hadn't had much proximity to Black people until they got thrown in the middle of East Oakland. And though our campus was quite idyllic and overwhelmingly white at that time, when they would step outside the gates, it would literally be Too Short selling his record from 75 Girls Records on a cassette tape, talking about, "Bitch! So, you know, they were really, you know, there was a culture shock there and they didn't really get it. So I used to do these events to fundraise for the Black Women's Collective, and I would have hip hop artists come and speak on the panel. So you actually got to hear from the artists and not just watch them perform. But then afterward, they would do showcases. So I had artists like Del the Funky Homo Sapien.
You're swept a hurricane. Del will blur your brain. So your next generations of youth will be facing the truth. And the truth is I'll leave you with the loose tooth. Gums get split.
Mystic. Troop 187, shout out to Adisa Benjoko.
For example, look at Colin Powell. Talk about a nigga who threw in his towel, killing for his master. Stupid Black bastard, his own people, he left in disaster. So if you're black.
The late, great African Identity, who I found out passed away this week.
Because now OJ killed her, it's integration in the cemetery. Styles Barry, Jesus' mother's first name was Mary. Buddha was a black man, saved my soul.
So many different artists come on, Hieroglyphics, and we really did try to educate the community about what the Bay Area hip hop scene was, how diverse it was. And one year, Short and Hammer were in the audience. And for me, that was like, oh my God, the two biggest independent artists, you know, aside from E-40 at that time, are in the audience at this college event that I put on. Like, so yeah, that was an amazing moment.
That was amazing. And they'll gave you plenty of experience for the Gavin panels you would put on, which we'll definitely talk about in depth as, you know,
yeah,
a little further in.
They were literally the lily pad that I, you know, used to jump to Gavin, because Kelly Wu, who was the rap editor before me at that time, was also in the audience one year. And he said, you know, look, I just got this job at Priority Records. I'm moving to LA in 2 weeks. Will you come interview for my job? And that was how I became the rap editor at Gavin. So
amazing. And so Gavin, for people who might not know it, is basically a radio trade magazine, right?
Yes. Established in San Francisco. And we had the Gavin seminar that went along with that. It was a multi-format magazine, but I ran the rap charts from 1993 to 1998. And I was the first woman, the first African-American, and the youngest person to be the rap editor. And then from that point, the seminar for the first time started to move from San Francisco to Atlanta and New Orleans. And so it kind of gave other artists from different regions the opportunity to have access to that national record and radio population of industry people.
Yeah. And so those seminars, you know, in sort of the early and mid 90s, can you kind of set the scene? What would they be like?
So the Gavin seminar was a private industry event, and they gave the radio industry an opportunity to interact in an informal way with the record industry. Well, typically two sort of opposing forces, because they need each other, but they also are at odds with each other, you know, in a lot of respects. So it brought those two communities together to talk about the state of the business. And at that time, hip hop was still very much a college and community radio phenomenon in terms of its airplay and how people received the music. You had to find it on your own or listen to a college or a community station really to get you know, a long-term playlist or an authentic experience of hip-hop on the radio until 1996, the Telecom Act of 1996.
I was gonna bring that up, yeah.
Created this consolidation moment where mainstream radio stations could own as many stations in the market as they wanted.
Yeah, so you're working in radio when that bill passed.
Yes,
basically.
Yeah, and that seminar, 1996 in Atlanta, I remember it being a real watershed moment for the people at the convention, because people were really nervous. They were like, "Well, what's going to happen once all these, you know, conglomerates start buying up these stations?" Well, it's going to create duplication, and it's going to mean people are going to lose their jobs, and it's going to mean that you're not going to be able to gut program anymore. It's going to mean the end of mixes as you know it on the radio. And it's going to mean a controlled playlist. And when I would say this to these audiences, they would kind of look at me like, yeah, right. And that's exactly what happened. So the people who understood that made plans to go into syndicated radio. And then you have the rise of people like Sway and Tech.
Wake up show.
Two disc jockeys breaking so many freaking needles. I wonder if they
and Flex and the Baker Boys, you know, they went into syndication. And then after 96, satellite radio came into prominence. And so you saw some of the bigger hip hop DJs, you know, take advantage of that. But for the most part, it really did obliterate that gut programming and the diversity of artist voices that we had in the golden era up until that point.
Thank you, Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
So there was this other thing that happened in radio in the 90s, right? Where you had hip hop, and you know, we've talked to other people about this on the record industry, on the label side of things, not really embraced by Black radio, but starting to be embraced by pop radio right around the time you were at Gavin. What were the long-term effects of that dynamic as far as you could see?
Well, unfortunately, traditional Black radio had a real moral issue with hip hop music because it was explicit, because it was raw, because it, you know, was an indictment in a lot of ways of that generation. And so as a result, a lot of that airplay did not happen from Black radio. You know, they didn't feel like rap was real music. They focused more on R&B. This is before the New Jack Swing era, where R&B and hip hop sort of melded together.
Yeah.
And then their hand was sort of forced that they had to play Mary J. Blige and Method Man because, hello, Mary J. Blige, right?
Shorty, I'm there for you anytime you need me. For real, girl, it's me in your world. Believe me, nothing make a man.
So, you know, up until that point, though, there was a real shying away from playing essentially what was the next generation's music, the next generation's rock and roll. And as a result, mainstream radio was given that door to step right in and provide hip hop music with that mainstream platform that Black radio stations would not provide. And it ended up backfiring, I think, on Black radio in a lot of ways, because a lot of that generation, A, stop listening, which means your advertising is going to be affected. And then on top of that, there was this feeling of abandonment on the part of the hip hop generation. Like our own, you know, our own media outlets have turned their back on us just because they don't like what we're saying. When in fact, you know, we're carrying through a tradition, you know, that is part of our musical continuum.
In fact, sometimes literally using music from the previous generation as the, you know, bed for the song.
Absolutely. In the minds of hip hop artists, there was no disrespect. It was like, we love this music and we're sampling it and we're using it as a base or, you know, as a complement to what we do. But the station owners saw it differently. And, you know, the content, while, you know, it's going to raise eyebrows and whatever else, this is America. We have free speech and you have to choose. And then there were clean versions made by mainstream pop radio stations. So they solved the problem.
Right.
You know, why couldn't Black radio negotiate this, right?
Yeah.
So it was unfortunate.
Yeah. And, you know, during your time at Gavin, you gave a lot of people their first big magazine covers, you know, people like Common and D'Angelo, stuff like that. What was the tipping point for you when you see someone at that stage? What was it about an artist that made you think, okay, they're ready for prime time, like I'm ready to give them the cover?
A lot of the time it would be me canvassing my stations to just find out, you know, who is getting reaction with you when you play their records? Who are you hearing about even on the street before you hear about it from, you know, your other friends in radio is bubbling under? Who do you feel has been overlooked and now it's their season? And so there was that, but then there was also sort of my own, because I've just been a music head since forever. I mean, I was cleaning the house to Gil Scott-Heron and The Last Poets and all that stuff, you know, living with my parents. So for me, as a music head, I always wanted to sort of handpick that next artist who I felt radio needed to pay more attention to if they weren't necessarily giving me that feedback. So in the case of Bone Thugs and Harmony, it was kind of like, wait, why do you want to give these five kids from Cleveland the cover? And I was like, explain it to my editor, like, hello, Eazy-E, right? Yeah, so, right.
Ruthless Records was formed in 1986 by Eazy-E and Jerry Heller to be used as an outlet to release both NWA and Eazy's solo work. Its first successful single was Eazy's 1987 hit, Boys in the Hood, and its first two records were JJ Fad's Supersonic and NWA's Straight Outta Compton. In 1995, Eazy-E was diagnosed with AIDS. He had just signed the five-member group Bone Thugs and Harmony, whose debut 1994 EP, Creepin' on a Come Up, became wildly popular. He executive produced their first full-length album, E-1999 Eternal, but died of AIDS-related pneumonia before the album's release. Their smash 1995 single, The Crossroads, was dedicated to Eazy-E and helped push the album to multi-platinum success. After his death, the label was taken over by Eazy-E's wife, Tamika Wright. Due to a shift in promotions and marketing, the label's artists began leaving for other recording homes. Into 1996, only MC Ren, Kid Frost, and Bone Thugs remained. And even those acts eventually departed, though re-releases of previous projects have appeared since then. Ruthless Records is now a division of Epic Records.
So, you know, sometimes there would be that push-pull. And, you know, coming from Cleveland, it's certainly a tertiary market. Like, it's not L.A., it's not New York, it's not even Atlanta or Miami, where so much hip-hop was coming from at that time. But to me, the music and their story really were compelling for me to put them on the cover. And then when I thought about how Tamika Woods Wright was, you know, a driving force in making sure that Eazy's legacy was carried forward, and Bone Thugs and Harmony were a big part of that, it also gave me an angle to tell the story and involve a woman in hip hop without it being like, oh, women in hip hop, you know, because I really
the
hate
women
when,
in hip hop issue.
I hate
or whatever,
when, you know, yeah, women get ghettoized within hip hop, like we aren't just part of hip hop. Like, you know, right now, you know, whether you're a fan of Nicki Minaj or not, you have to give it to her. She is one of the most impactful hip hop artists, gender notwithstanding. You know, MC Light, Queen Latifah, these are people who are pioneers, gender notwithstanding. They're not good because they rap like a girl. They're dope because they're dope.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to do that story for a woman executive. But as a CEO of Ruthless, she absolutely deserved a big part of that story. So it gave that cover a dynamic that your typical cover wouldn't have. And so, yeah, that was a natural. Lady of Rage, just because she was one of the first artists, I think if not the first artist, signed to Death Row Records.
Give them, let it hit them, split them, did it, now I'm rid of them, yeah, I put that on my unborn. newborn kids. Rage in effect, so you know how it is. I rock rough and stuff with my Afro pumps.
And it took her 7 years to have her record come out. I wanted to talk to her about why. So I put her on the cover, even though at that point she just had one huge single. And people were looking at me like, wait, how does she deserve the cover? And I'm like, right. See, I'm not Rolling Stone. I'm not going to give a cover after they sell a million records. Like, my job as a rap editor of Gavin is to give a cover for whoever is next to blow.
Right.
You know, so Rage was, she made perfect sense. D'Angelo and Common, certainly. And then for Scarface, it was a unique situation because he was already well established as a member of the Ghetto Boys. But I felt like he deserved a cover as a solo artist because it was such a departure musically from what he had been doing as a member of the Ghetto Boys.
My goes on in the streets of my hood. When you die, go some cry, it gets bop. While others choose to wonder why. His life was took at such an early age. A young nigga who lived in a rage, died by the gauge. He used to hustle on a...
And I really wanted to help him redefine himself in the minds of radio.
Yeah.
And he had some really huge crossover hits, you know, after that as a solo artist. So shout out to Brad, shout out to Marlon Snyder, who wrote that cover story for Gavin at that time. And it was a beautiful run. Like, it, you know, I feel so blessed to have been in a position of power in the national scene at that time, because it was just a really, it was a really beautiful time for the music in terms of the artistry and in terms of the possibilities from an industry standpoint.
Yeah. And as a writer during that period and even before, who were you looking to? Like, who were kind of your influences as far as, you know, music writing?
Ooh, this is a good question. You might have to pause me on this one. Geesh. Okay, so certainly Billy Jam, who was a West Coast contributor to The Source, which was really important at that time. Cheo Coker, amazing. And now he's writing on television shows. Shout out to Cheo on Luke Cage, which is just, I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's so fantastic. I love his work. Who else? You know, there was a really strong group of us. And then actually my peers at other trade books, I really respected. Daniel Smith was at Vibe, but huge, huge influence on me just because she, you know, came from the Bay Area newspaper circuit and then went on to write and, you know, edit for Vibe. And then, you know, Sheena Lester was my contemporary at Rap Pages, you know, a consumer facing book, but still doing incredible work covering hip hop music. And I also really appreciated, you know, just other women at trade magazines, Jennifer Norwood, Shanita Williams, Elaine, you know, we had a real commitment, even though we were very much behind the scenes, to really covering hip hop in a way that mainstream books just weren't doing. Like, we were being ignored. Like, you know, major brands didn't care about hip hop. You know, radio was just starting to care about hip hop. It hadn't quite become this obvious cash cow. And so at that point, you know, really we were committed to representing the music, you know, from a point of passion.
Yeah. And at Gavin, one of the, you know, complicated things that happened that you ran into was, as you were rap editor, they brought in a man to essentially be your boss and look over, I think it was all of Black music, even though he didn't know anything about rap and kind of cared even less about it. How'd you deal with that when that happened?
You know, whew, man, that was crazy because I was really young and I didn't have, this was like my first sort of real job, like a corporate job. When I was working at the booking agency, it was very like, come in, do your work, have lunch with the team, go home, or go do homework, whatever, right? Now I'm in the real world at this job. And I didn't really know how to handle that. But I also felt like I know what I know about hip hop music, you know, and I've made it my business to become a student of hip hop music to the point where I now feel like I'm an authority. And if I'm writing a column every week and I'm talking to 300 stations every week, I know something about hip hop, right? So to have someone brought in over me just because I was young, and I think also too, because I was a woman, it was kind of like, well, what is this young girl really going to do? What does she know? Right? Is she going to be able to make this format generate the income that Kelly Wu had? I mean, remember, I was coming off of Kelly Wu's tenure and, you know, he helped to break Wu-Tang Clan. So like, there was pressure.
Yeah.
Shout out to Kelly Wu. Anyway, within 6 months, it became clear that I didn't need someone over me in terms of the hip hop format. And all I was doing was my work every week. It wasn't like I had to do much more than that, because eventually you could just see I was producing the rap programming for the seminar. I was talking to the stations every week. And at the end of the day, whenever any of the label reps, VPs on down that were dealing with hip hop, wanted answers, they were calling me.
To you. Yeah.
So it took care of itself with me just continuing to be committed to excellence in the work. And unfortunately, it doesn't always work like that. Sometimes there is somebody who's gunning for you, or who wants your demise, or who is jealous of you, or whatever the case may be. And you have to fight differently. You really have to, you know, use the system mm-hmm. to protect yourself. And fortunately, this wasn't the case for me. You know, I loved my job and was just so geeked to be able to do this for a living.
Yeah.
So, you know, writing and music together in a job. Okay, I don't care if I have to sleep over every Thursday night to get this chart out. It's worth doing because I'm passionate about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the end, it worked out. And I just continued to make sure that there was nothing about the work I was doing that wouldn't reinforce the reputation that I had set for myself. So, you know, as long as you're doing the work and it's excellent and nobody can step to you about it, it makes it harder for, you know, all that extra stuff to kind of penetrate. So.
And one final thing about your time at Gavin, there was a seminar. You can tell me, I'm not exactly sure of the year, but you met a DJ Polo was carting around this teenager from Queens.
Yeah. Now, see, this was before I started working there.
Oh.
When I was at Gavin, it was 1993 to 1998. Now, I met DJ Polo, who was carting around a young teenager from Queens by the name of Nasir Jones. Years before that, I think it was 1991, that Gavin seminar at the St. Francis in San Francisco.
Wow.
And I went because I'm a hip hop head and I just want to be in the scene. This is, you know, and I'm doing the panels and stuff at school. I graduated in 92. So I think that's about right. It was either 1990 or 1991 for that seminar. I just went to the lobby because I didn't have a badge. So I was like, you know what? Let me just go in the lobby. Again, no one's paying attention to hip hop. There's no security. There's no police. And meanwhile, Gangstar, Public Enemy, Nas, Curious George, like whoever was whoever from the East Coast was in San Francisco for this event. So I just came in and kind of scoped the room out and was like, wow, EPMD is over there. Wow, Kool G Rap and DJ Polo over here. Let me go introduce myself. They were like, oh, hey, cool. And they're with this dude. He had on some sweatpants, big afro, just kind of looking like he just rolled out of bed. And it was Nas. And so, you know, Polo's introducing me to him. And he was like, yeah, what's up, Ma? How you doing? Nice to meet you. None of us have any idea that, well, they probably knew that Nas was going to become Nas. But I didn't know that I'd become the rap editor of this magazine where I was kind of like sliding into their thing in the lobby, right?
Yeah.
And I certainly had no idea that many years later, in 1999, I would end up at Sony Music as Nas's advertising copywriter. And then go on to write 6 album campaigns for him and forge a really beautiful working relationship, you know, to the point where I was texting him or, you know, getting him scripts for his promos, because Nas didn't like having anyone voice his promos but him. He wanted his own voice on his commercials to kind of set that tone, that mood of like Queensbridge, right? No voiceover announcer at that time was going to capture that. So he would just say, yeah, Ma. Shout out to David Belgrave, his product manager at the time. He would just say, yeah, Ma, have Dave send me your script, or you send it to me, whatever. I'll take care of it for you in the studio and I'll get it back to you guys. And then y'all, you know, y'all put my voice on it.
This is Nas, the Streets Disciple, bringing you Illmatic, 10th Anniversary, Platinum Edition. My first LP remastered, Illmatic, unreleased, 4 new remixes, including It Ain't Hard to Tell and The World Is Yours. Also out March 30th, Video Anthology, Volume 1, 14 clips, 1 DVD, y'all. Illmatic, 10th Anniversary, Platinum Edition, Video Anthology, Volume 1. In stores Tuesday, March 30th.
So that was how, you know, Nas would do, he would voice his own promos for the various albums, and just being able to watch his creative process, being able to sort of ghostwrite for him on his album campaigns, you know, was beautiful. And as a result, I got to meet and work with Jonathan Mannion, Ola Kudu, fantastic creatives. So, you know, and I met Salam Remy. It was just amazing that that moment in St. Francis would then connect to me, you know, writing advertising for Stillmatic and for that epic battle between him and Jay-Z with Ether and The Takeover, right? So, yeah. Like, just a hip-hop head's dream, like a writer's dream, for me to be, like, living in that same continuum where I would be that that young girl who, you know, just wanted to be a part of a scene and then go to, you know, actually helping an incredible, iconic artist tell his story, you know, through this album.
As a side note, was there ever, I don't remember, were there ever any ads directly addressing the Nas J beef?
Oh, yeah.
Beef? Yeah.
We had, because Ether, I think, eventually became a single.
Heard it when I was asleep that this Jay-Z and Cockefeller Records wanted beef.
And so we had, even if it was at college radio, I mean, I can't recall now, as many years ago, but we did have print ads that basically said that Nas was the king of New York. And so we were saying this in our advertising definitively and going right at the battle. And, you know, he loved that. He was like, yeah, of course I am. You know, so no matter who you think won the battle, it was one of those epic lyrical contests. And I was just grateful to be a part of it. And, you know, even though Jay-Z and I share a birthday, December 4th, I, you know, on that one, I was definitely Team Nas. So,
and, you know, it seems like as good a time as any to move into your time at Sony a little bit. You were there like 98 to 04, right around there, which was both the music industry's commercial height, sort of where CDs were, you know, selling like hotcakes.
For $23 each.
Yeah.
Which led to.
And then, right. And then immediately, and then also during the period where the bottom started to fall out.
That's right. So the
what was it like being at like a giant record company while this was happening?
It was pretty schizo. Like, one minute we're writing ads. Well, I'm writing ads and I'm conceiving campaigns for, I mean, huge priorities, right? Miseducation of Lauryn Hill was my first project when I got to Sony. And then Jermaine Dupri's Life in 1472, which had the aforementioned awesome Jay-Z and Jermaine with Money Ain't a Thing, right? Huge record.
Yeah. In the Ferrari and Jaguar, switching four lanes from top down, screaming out Money Ain't a Thing.
Bubble hard in the double law, flashing the rings with the window crack, holla back, Money Ain't a Thing.
So then you get to, and I believe Nas's record at that time was Nostradamus.
Yeah, I think that was 99,
and, yeah. Yeah, so the year 2000 comes, and labels are starting to sue users of Napster. And we're like, what? And then the next assignment that comes down is, we need to do an anti-piracy campaign, because this is getting crazy. Like, labels started hemorrhaging, right? And our campaign budgets went from, you know, huge, huge numbers to shoestring budgets. Then there was this pressure for artists to start putting out more records more often. And at one point, you know, even Nas was kind of being asked to turn around albums within, like, you know, 18-month periods. And it was just getting to be kind of crazy. It's like, you got to give artists a chance to live and then have a concept and then record. Like, you know, it was crazy. Like, DMX, even though he wasn't on the label I was working with, he was putting out records like almost every year. So you could see the pressure starting to happen from the label side. You could see that pressure starting to trickle down to the artists. And then it didn't seem to even matter, because they still weren't selling enough records, because the downloading and the ripping was just, it was like wildfire and it was out of control. And there was no way for the labels, who were so attached and committed financially and psychologically to brick and mortar retail, there was no real way for them to wrap their minds around, well, how are we going to solve this problem? And by the time they realized it was a real problem, Steve Jobs solved the problem for them, and iTunes had come along. So when, I mean, personally, I feel like labels could have come together as a coalition to try to acquire the Napsters of the world and then turn them into their own vehicle for online sale. But they had the adverse and hostile reaction to right. Napster, and it really backfired on the entire business. And that sort of competition that labels had between one another, I think, got the best of labels because they couldn't even come to the table behind their own, you know, label to label, whatever, in the interest of the industry that supports all of them. Right. Yeah. So yeah, iTunes comes in and, you know, no shade to Apple, but they don't make records. So I think intrinsically there isn't a full understanding of what it takes to make a record and how expensive that really is. Not to say labels should have been selling CDs for $23 a pop. That wasn't right either. But I definitely feel like the decompartmentalization of albums for 99 cents a piece, you know, messes with the integrity of what the artist intended for the consumer to have or experience. And it turned that business into a singles-driven business instead of an album-driven business. And that changed the tenor of how artists recorded and what radio ended up playing. And so when people want to get upset about, oh, how, you know, how music sounds now or what's going on, I mean, there was not only a creative brain drain from the labels because they hemorrhaged as a result of the downloading, you know, massacre, but there was a talent drain as well. And so when you don't have artist development and you don't have those executives who are record people, who are music people, who are committed to that craft of making records, you're going to get a different level of quality and a different level of artistry.
Right. You end up doing this thing that, you know, making records by committee, essentially having the same batch of producers and songwriters go from artist to artist to artist.
And then you also have sort of, you know, A&R by the numbers as opposed to by the gut. Like, well, who's selling on the street, or, you know, who's down with the biggest click right now? Well, let's give them a deal.
Right.
And as a result, you have this this monotonous landscape as opposed to a diversity of voices, you know. So you have fewer styles, you have less gender balance, you have less, you know, lyricism. You don't have the same sort of depth of experience in lyrics that you hear, because the same people are getting deals. So you're not hearing from people from places like Cleveland or places like Oklahoma or wherever, you know, and they don't have the same access to the opportunity to be heard on a mainstream level.
And during your time at Sony, you worked with like the biggest of the big stars, right? You mentioned Lauryn Hill. You haven't yet mentioned people like Beyonce or Will Smith. When you get to that level of an artist, of this kind of superstar, how involved would they be in their ad campaigns? Like, would you interact with them? Would you explain your vision? Would you get their input?
It really varied. Lauren was very hands-on and very, you know, like, I want it this way, or this is the conversation that I want my audience to have with my music. Another artist that was also very hands-on and very, as you might expect, opinionated about the work was 50 Cent, and I enjoyed working with him tremendously. I wrote his very first album campaign, The Power of the Dollar, when he was signed to Columbia Records. And, you know, he really helped me in terms of distilling what it is they want to get across and keeping the integrity of the artist and the music at the same time. As we write advertising campaigns and as we conceive ways to get the message out on these outlets that have no idea what's going on in Jamaica, Queens, don't even know who Curtis is. But we have to keep the integrity of what he created when we go into these outlets and when we advertise in these spaces. Nas was also very hands-on, as you see. He didn't even want anybody voicing his promos. Beyonce was definitely hands-on in the sense of like, this is what works and this is what doesn't work. But it wasn't like I saw her a lot and you know, was with her all the time. And you got to remember, Destiny's Child was constantly working. So when it came time to do her solo album, she was very, you know, very involved.
2003 belongs to Beyonce. Dangerously in Love includes the smash hits Crazy in Love and Baby Boy. Her ladies anthem, Me, Myself, and I.
She's one of those artists who I have a tremendous amount of respect for because she's very specific about her vision and she's so driven. And she also is an incredibly genuine and cool person. So like when I hear people talking about, oh, Beyonce this, I'm like, guys, dude, she is like salt of the earth, super nice. Like what? Where is the hate coming from? She works so hard and so many people, you know, are touched by what she does. Like, let her live. You know, same thing with Kelly Rowland, Michelle Williams, all wonderful young ladies. LaToya Luckett. So, yeah, like everybody was different. With Will Smith, I did not have any contact with him. I wrote 4 album campaigns for Will Smith. However, he was also a huge movie star at the same time. Right. So, you know, it was kind of like, okay, well, how do you want to do this, T? Okay, well, we're good with it. And then, you know, they would shoot it up to management. And at some point, they'd get back to us. And if management said yes, then that meant Will was happy and we would just move forward. I didn't meet Will Smith until much later. It varied. And he was also on the West Coast when he wasn't shooting movies. And I was in New York, so there was no contact. But, you know, I have a tremendous amount of respect for Will and what he, you know, what he did and the fact that he stayed him the whole time. The whole time that the gangster rap thing was on fire, he was still Will Smith, yeah. You know, and there was nothing wrong with that. And, you know, 10 million records later, nobody's going to clown him. You know, it's like, okay, he's selling records in a market where nobody can sell records right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, salute to Will Smith.
In your book, which is about, you know, following your dreams and, you know, getting into entertainment and sort of all of the different jobs available in it, you talk about the importance of mentorship, especially for women. And you hope, I think, even the book can kind of serve as a, you know, virtual mentor. Does that focus on mentorship have something to do with why so much of your work, both in the book and on your personal blog, it focuses on, you know, other women in the industry, your friends, your coworkers, rather than your own story?
Yes. So the book is called Put Your Dreams First, Handle Your Entertainment Business. It's on Amazon. You can get it physical or digital. And I did not put myself on the cover or put a woman on the cover because even though I interview over 90 different women about their business experiences across all these different areas of the business, not just music, but TV, film, legal, production, publishing, so on and so forth, new media, international business. Even though I did that, I wanted anyone and everyone, gender irrespective, to have access to this book. And I didn't want a woman or me being on it to be the reason they would say, oh, this book isn't for me. So I put a blinged out microphone on it, which kind of was feminine-ish. And this is like, you know, not thinking about like Master P and his old artwork and stuff. But like, you know, I just wanted kind of something that would say, you know, this is for those voices that you haven't heard, you know, who live behind the scenes in the industry. And I ended up with a ton of male readers as a result. And so many of them would come up to me at signings and events and say, you know, this book had so much real talk in it and so much substantive information, like real world strategy in it. And so I'm very grateful that, you know, people have come to the book realizing that the information is solid from a business standpoint. It's not solid because everybody in it happens to be a woman. So I did that book because when I started in the business, a lot of the time I was the only woman or I was one of a handful of women and then certainly a smaller handful of women of color. So when I would go to places, women and young girls, people who were even already in the industry would like bum rush me after panels and events like help me, mentor me, blah, blah. And I could never give that many people my full attention. And I still felt like I was learning. So I then just sort of turned that around and said, you know what, let me do some empirical research. Let me try to, you know, gather some data on who these women want to hear from and what questions I should be asking. And I just took that task on and I got a lot of feedback. I did, I think, an initial survey of 300 or 400 people just to ask those questions. And then I got back who should be in the book. And then I added a bunch of people. And then word got out that I was doing this book. And then people added themselves. And then it turned into like 90 women that I was interviewing. And then it took 6 years to get done because I was still working full time at Sony. And by this time I had a son and on and on. So it was a labor of love. And 7 years after I embarked on it, the book came out. And it's still the only book of its kind that really focuses on business. It's an official business title. It's not a self-help book from the woman's perspective in entertainment, and still getting Instagram posts with the cover and like, oh, this book, I'm rereading it. I'm making notes in it. You know, it's really a guide for people. And you know, that just, that makes me feel good. That's my way of, you know, giving back and sort of honoring my mom's legacy. I dedicated the book to her. She was a social worker and she did, you know, things for everyday people that I would never have the patience or the, you know, the fortitude to do, you know, working with everyone from the elderly to inmates to the mentally ill. And for me, this was my way of sort of, you know, being a social worker within the industry for, you know, women and girls primarily, but anybody who wanted to get in the business or anyone who was already in it and was trying to figure out how to navigate it and change lanes so that they could do something else, but still be working in a place that is a point of passion for them.
Just to get to one of the more timely things, we're a few weeks away now as we speak, and even closer by the time this airs, to a short film you produced called Biscuit premiering. What can you tell us about the film?
Yes.
And where is it premiering?
So Biscuit is premiering at the Oktoberfest Film Festival in New York City on October 3rd at 6 p.m. as part of the U-Front Forecast event that is going on during the festival. And shout out to Roger Maloney for, you know, having the vision to have us join his event. We are super excited. It's a short film that was made to basically serve as a visual calling card to a feature-length screenplay that the director, Tank Burt, wrote called Skateboard Skateboard, which is a family skate drama.
Starring your own son.
Starring Mecca, yes. Skater extraordinaire. And we took that screenplay for the feature-length film to Sundance. The director placed third in their Gladiator pitch competition. And we said, you know what, we need to take this a step further and just do a little something. So we shot a few scenes from that screenplay and it became the short film Biscuit. And it premiered at the Black Star Film Festival in Philly in August. And we are really excited to have the New York City premiere happen October 3rd.
Excellent. We'll have more information about that on thecyphershow.com. And you have a ton of film projects. You have two short films that you wrote and directed, and, you know, a bunch of other things in the works. Looking at all that, one of the things that was most interesting to me was a docuseries that you have in progress called Throwing Shade about the New York City ballroom scene.
With this docuseries, a world once defined by shadow is brought to light. A courageous, diverse set of individuals illuminate what it means to be gay, transgender, and transsexual, but ultimately, what it means to be human. Introducing Throwin' Shade, House of New York. The housewives, sports wives, and mafia wives have had their moment. It's time we heard what the men of the house have to say.
At least to my viewing, it looked like a lot of the trailer focused on the ballroom scenes, like appropriation by pop culture. And, you know, some of the films made about it have been kind of controversial over the years.
Sure.
And things like that. Do you view your series as a corrective to that?
Yes. So Throwin' Shade is a docuseries that focuses on Black and brown men in the ballroom scene here in New York. So it's Throwin' Shade, House of New York. The show was created by William Robinson, who is a celebrity hairstylist and who is immersed in that culture, and Dre Ebony, who is one of the godfathers of the House of Ebony here in New York. And Michelle Joyce, who is a marketing maven who comes from the record industry, introduced me to those gentlemen and brought me on as a producer. And I was just so blown away by what I saw, by the cast and by their commitment to really taking the LGBT community away from this idea of being the token or the butt of the joke or, you know, the flash of flavor on said reality competition show, and really focusing on who they are and what they do. And this idea that there were some of these people in this cast who had different lives, who were not necessarily out in their daytime lives, but at night would be in this ballroom scene and find immense freedom and liberation within that. And a couple of the cast members were willing, because of who was involved, to actually have their two lives come together in this show. And they were okay with whoever watched it finding out who they really were. And that really spoke to me. So I became an executive producer on this show. And we produced these trailers. And we are now raising the money to shoot the pilot because we have some interest from some production companies, but they really want to see the cast interacting. So we had them do a confessional shoot and then we created the trailer from that. But now we're going to take it a step further. So yes, we will soon be probably crowdfunding along with doing some private investment, you know, financing for this pilot. And we're looking to shoot that before the end of the year, actually before it gets cold. So Throwing Shade is a really important project for me because as a filmmaker, I just want to tell the stories that aren't being told from the perspectives of those same people who are living those stories. And when you think about all of the source material from dance to fashion to makeup to just movement in general, so much of that comes from the ballroom scene. And we have no idea that when we're watching Madonna. We're watching Nicki Minaj. We're watching, you know, any of these huge pop stars, Lady Gaga, that they're sourcing that world. So I want to bring people into that world and help them learn and become compassionate about, you know, the people in that world.
And one final thing, as a leading voice in the Grapegate controversy, are you still certain after all the debate that Big meant Welch's grape juice?
Plans to leave, throw the keys to Little C's, pull the truck up front and roll up the next blunt so we can steam on the way to the telly, go fill my belly, a T-bone steak, cheese, eggs, and Welch's grape conversation.
These lyrics from Notorious B.I.G.'s Big Papa have sparked one of the most crucial internet debates in the history of, well, history. After posting a meme that featured a picture of the described meal with eggs, a steak, and a bottle of Welch's grape juice, former Cypher guest who joined Mr. Len on episode 36, Mila Machinko, sparked a vital conversation. When Biggie says, "So we can steam on the way to the telly, go fill my belly, a T-bone steak, cheese, eggs, and Welch's grape," which Welch's grape was he talking about? Jelly juice or soda? This led to an actual debate among those who had dined with B.I.G. and knew him, and there was even a trip to the diner reference in the song to attempt to settle the story once and for all. For more on the story, check out Cypher host Sean Sotero's article on Forbes, linked in the show notes, and look up the hashtag Grapegate on Twitter.
Yes, I am still certain because it doesn't change the history of what I experienced with B.I.G. himself. He and I had breakfast at Gavin literally 4 days before his untimely passing. Shout out to B.I.G. And he had Welch's grape juice at breakfast. So since I saw that, I'm Team Juice. And I even have a hashtag for that. It's Team Juicy, okay? Team Juicy all the way. No jelly, no soda, okay? He may have had Welch's grape soda at some point because, yes, he's from Brooklyn. I get that. But, like, he had gone from ashy to classy at that point and realized the power of the juice. And since I saw him drinking it firsthand, that's where I'm at. And I want you to know, shout out to Mila Machinko, I want you to know that Grapegate is going to actually happen in person in a round table. We are actually considering going to the Country House Diner, ordering the meal, and seeing what happens as that takes place. And if we get Lil C's to the table, it's really going to be on. So I want to just say that C's, we're checking for you, brother. Come to the table, meet us at the Country House, and you know, let's see what's up with that. So yeah, Team Juicy, Grapegate is amazing. You know, shout out to Forbes.com for recognizing the value and the power of this debate in pop culture. And it's another example of women really driving hip hop thought, right? And just driving these conversations. Mila put it up on her Facebook page and it just took on a life of its own. It was just incredible. So it's been a wild ride, and I'm just grateful that, you know, I was in the right place at the right time in history to witness the juice.
Well, thank you so much, Thembisa Mshaka. October 3rd, Biscuit premiering. I have the date right?
Yes.
October 3rd, Biscuit is premiering. so much stuff we didn't even get to talk about. Islamic speed dating, your two short films.
I love that you're dropping names, though. That's so amazing. Yes. So more to come, more to come.
More Islamic, to come.
Islamic speed dating is my next project. That's my feature screenplay. And, you know, I'm starting to actually get actors attached, which is incredible. So feeling good about that. And if people want to connect with me, can I tell them how to
of
find
course,
me?
Of course, please.
Is that cool?
Please.
All right. So on Twitter, I'm Put Your Dreams First, named after the title of my book. It's Put YR Dreams, the number one ST on Twitter. On Instagram, I'm Official Lip Game, because even though I'm a B-girl, I'm still very much a girly girl when it comes to makeup and lip color. So that's kind of what I do on Instagram. And my blog and my own site are tembisamshaka.com. So I look forward to seeing everybody on these here internets. And Sean, thank you so much for the opportunity to be on The Cypher. It's just a huge honor. And Lisa Cortez, she is my mentor, and she is a loved one. And if I can be half the filmmaker that she is, then I will have done my job.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Talking to Tembisa gave me a real history of hip-hop, from the genre's mainstreaming in the 90s to the decline of the record industry in the early aughts, all the way to today's multimedia climate. Her book, Put Your Dreams First, Handle Your Entertainment Business, is well worth the read for anyone of any gender who wants to get into the field. And if you're in New York City, make sure to check out her film Biscuit this coming Saturday at the Oktoberfest Film Festival. As for Grapegate, our producer Josh is firmly in the Biggie meant all three camp, while I'm just enjoying the debate. What do you think? Let us know at The Cypher Show on pretty much any social media. As I mentioned at the top, make sure you subscribe on your podcast app of choice. If that app happens to be iTunes, give us a rating or review. If you want to take an extra step to support the show, you can make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Even a couple bucks a month will go a long way. More information about this or any other episode, including playlists and a lot more, can be found at thecyphershow.com. Join us next week when our guests will be M.F. Grimm and his producer, Drazar Monumental. Grimm, in addition to being the man who gave M.F. Doom his current name, has had a long and fascinating career going all the way back to the days of park jams at Rocksteady Park in Manhattan. From getting shot on the eve of his first record deal, to hanging out with Death Row during their glory days, to helping to make some of the most beloved underground hip-hop of all time, this is an episode you're not going to want to miss. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
Bitch!
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He had gone from ashy to classy at that point.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Not to say labels should have been selling CDs for $23 a pop. That wasn't right either.
Special thanks to Mila Machenko for creating the whole Grapegate debate in the first place.
It's been a wild ride, and I'm just grateful that, you know, I was in the right place at the right time in history.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
I mean, today's technology is so awesome for this. Like,